I was happy for day two. Can we grab our seats and get started here, please? So, briefly, Bob told me we had several members step up on his challenge for the fire project, and we're $9,000 short of the $50,000 goal, right, Bob? So before you guys get out of town, if there's anyone that wants to help us get that project fully funded, it would be much appreciated.
Order 1,000 in one day. Just need 9 more to make it 50.
All right, so I won't get into reading Don's bio here. Obviously, it's in the program, but we were just talking, and he's here to discuss safety. And as we were putting together the agenda, I kind of felt like that's a topic that this group ought to discuss every year. We got a lot of people out there around really big equipment, a lot of them, marginal amounts of English, and who knows if the supervisors are English or Spanish, but it's a challenge for all of our plants, and I think we got the right guy here to talk about it. I was telling him we just celebrated 5 years with a recordable incident at our plant up the road here in Cave City, Kentucky, and we had a big celebration because that's quite the accomplishment. But Don's coming up on, he's completed 24 years, coming up on 25 years at Lawrenceville, Virginia, so a hell of an accomplishment. I think we should give him a hand for that. And like I said, we got the right guy here to talk to us about safety, so Don, come on up.
Thank you. Well, good morning, everybody. Safety can be a real boring subject to talk about, but it is one of my passions. So, in the spirit of safety, I'm not a coat and tie kind of guy. So the first thing I'm going to do is get a little bit more into my normal world, which is in safety. So we'll strip this off. And along with that, we've got our Class 2 cut-resistant gloves, and we'll go ahead and do the hat and the glasses, and then I'll feel at home. Okay, so we're going to take you through a little short journey. First thing I need to do is tell you that the material provided is basically experiences of Scott's. In no way is it intended for anything other than informational purposes, and is not construed as any legal advice. You need to seek your own legal advice. So this is strictly informational. Quickly, we're going to go through who Scott's Miracle-Gro is, our EH&S team, our performance history, and we're going to talk about the top OSHA findings, key safety focus areas, associated engagement. Who are we? We're a $3 billion consumer company, 6,000 associates, 2,300 are in our supply chain, and we have 42 U.S. plants producing 270 million bags of soil and mulch a year. Our EH&S team, we have 7 people at our corporate office that support us. We have 7 regional managers that support us. And each of our factories, I think almost each factory has a safety person, and I think that's how most factories today have it. They have to have someone in charge of safety. So this is our history. In 2007, we were at about 2.5 TRIR, and we had a safety crusade, and our numbers came down to about 1.5, and then we see this climbing back up. Some of those are because we have acquisitions. Some of them are because we had volume that drove activity at the plant level. It's always hard to be really safe when you're running two shifts and you're running wide open through the weekends, and part of that is what pops up. Our largest activity here is sprains and strains. That's where 12% of our problems are. The next is cuts and lacerations and fractures. So if you look at that pie chart, that's where most of our injuries were. And of course, if you're a good manager, you want to take care of where your injuries are. So let's talk real quick about the top 10 OSHA findings. This is not in our industry, this is just in the world. The first one is electrical requirements. Basically, 1,700 violations, and they include equipment that's not installed right or not used in accordance to how it was designed to operate. The next one is electrical wiring. You can see from that example, it was never intended to have that many. And either you're using too many cords or in an overload, or things aren't rated. For example, you use an indoor cord that in an outdoor application. That had 1,940 violations in 2016. The next one is machine guarding, 2,451. And that's where either the guards were inadequate or someone had an injury because of a guard. Ladders were the next one at 2,600. And basically this usually is because the ladder is not tied off or you have a damaged ladder. Maybe no training. If you have take my advice, if you have a defective ladder, throw it away, give it away, do something to get it out of your house. The next one is powered industrial trucks. Now this one, we all understand because our industry is full of them. And we had 2,860 incidents with OSHA nationwide. And most of it has to do with lack of certification, lack of training, speed, people driving too fast. Driving too fast with a load in the air and they'll flip over. And then you also have maintenance. They're the big drivers for that. Lockout, tagout, I think that's the other big one that we're concerned about with our equipment. The top three instances are employees were not trained with proper lockout, tagout, or it didn't exist. We don't have a procedure for that machine to lock it out. That's a bad place to be. Or the employees did not perform their inspections on the equipment to make sure that they covered all the stored energy that would be with lockout, tagout. Respiratory, 3,500 violations, and that's where people who either weren't medically certified to wear a respirator, just because you have a dusty environment doesn't mean you can give someone a respirator and say, here, you're good to go. They may not be able to tolerate the restrictive breathing of a respirator, and therefore that's just as bad a violation as not having a respirator at all. And then you can get people who are overexposed thinking that a respirator is okay. Maybe a respirator cannot remove all the contaminants and you're putting your employees at risk. That one is a 3,500 violations. Scaffolding, we don't have much in our industry for that, but you can tell that people who do single family construction, framing, roofing, scaffolding is really important. And one of the leading reasons that they have injuries there is defective or inferior scaffolding, or they were poorly constructed. So the number two one is hazard communication. 5,677 OSHA violations. And I think we all have HAZCOM, but basically it's our responsibility to make sure that our associates know the chemicals that they're working with and what hazards they present to them. And you can't overemphasize that. If you get a OSHA inspection, I'll promise you one of the very first things they're going to ask for is, let me see your HAZCOM, let me see your book, and they're going to figure out whether you keep it up to date, whether you have all the chemicals that you're supposed to have in there, because if they're not complete, you're not protecting your associates. It's a right of the associate to know, and it's your responsibility to make sure that it's there. So 5,677, and then the number one, which is not much in our industry, it's kind of like the scaffolding. They go hand in hand, but 39% of the deaths, 39% of the deaths were because of falling, fall related. That's a huge number. If you add all these up, that means in 2016, OSHA had 35,000 industry violations. And we can say, well, all these don't apply to us. They don't, but I just want to give you a recap of what the world looks like as far as OSHA. So what do we do with it? We'll talk about Scotts for a minute. We took our internal and external audits, and we decided that we would look at lockout, tagout, machine guarding, powered industrial trucks, and electrical safety. They're the four that we said we're going to put our shoulder against, and we believe that we'll get the most bang for our buck. So lockout, tagout, we know what it is. It's a procedure to de-energize a machine. If you're going to pull maintenance or do some activity inside of an electrically powered, air powered, or even a gravity powered machine with stored energy, you've got to have a procedure that takes that out of the harm's way for the associate. You've got to have locks and tags that are used to designate the machinery as out of order. And for us, we have an annual review. Once a year, we have an annual lockout tagout review. So we'll take the associate, bring them to the machine. They work it every day. I mean, come on. They drive this piece of equipment or they operate this bagger every day. But we do a refresher and said, okay, this is what you have to have. These are your lockout points. And basically, we retrain them and do a review, and they sign off on it. Now, the sign-off is not to cover our behinds. The sign-off is just to demonstrate that we've gone back through this procedure. Because if you have an incident, someone would say, well, they didn't train me on that. You know, your documentation is very important to train your associates. Then we have we've done something called a cardinal rule. We have a cardinal rule process, and basically that means anyone that violates or bypasses a safety device knowingly and willingly, that's their last day. There is no, well, let's talk about it. Oh, he's a good guy. He's a strong supervisor. Or he's been here 30 years. None of that comes into play. A cardinal rule means you step over that line and we shake hands and you go home. That seems like a really harsh thing. And it is harsh. But if you violate those rules, you're putting not only yourself at risk, but your other employees at risk. And I think the company should think about implementing those rules. You could have a seatbelt rule that says, wear your seatbelt. Well, what do you do to someone who just decides they don't like seatbelts? You've got some compliant that do the seatbelt every day, and you have other people who blow it off. That's not a safety program. And if there's an injury and you have a rule that you have to have the seatbelts in use, and someone gets injured, and the person that didn't do that, the first thing that's going to come out is, well, why do you have a rule that you don't follow yourself? Cardinal rules kind of trues up that process, and it forces employees to make it important for them if they want a job. It's part of the job. So some of the standards that have kind of changed a little bit, there's a cord and plug equipment control. It used to be that, well, you just pull it out of the wall if it's a 110-volt item. Now the operator who's doing the maintenance has got to maintain control of that plug. Now he can put a lock on the plug, or he can hold it, or he can step on it, but he's got to maintain control of that plug. This is just another example of where, if it's a corded product, that the person working on it, these are wrappers and that's a drill, they just have to maintain control of that. Lockout tagout does apply to a drill press. It does apply to a 110-volt wrapper. You may not think it does, but it does. We also do something, and some of our member companies may do the same thing, but we have I think it's a cool program, but we have a machine-specific tag program. Brady, is the name of a tag company or software company. They sell a lot of your lockout tagout equipment, but they have a software that you can buy from them. And what it does is it simply takes this PT bagger, it hangs on the machine. If you have a new operator, maybe the operator runs a different bagger, a Hamer or a Hasten. And for the day, they're running a PT. You know, it's like, okay, so-and-so is missing, so we're going to move you over here. Well, they can operate the bagger, maybe, but when it comes to locking it out, they may not be specifically trained on that. They should be, but if they're not, this tag is really simple. It tells you that to lock out that device, you've got an electrical lockout and you have a pneumatic lockout. You've got one of each. It tells you what to do in both places, and you probably can't see it that well, but it actually shows a picture of the lock. So it sort of takes the thinking process out of the operator. It says, I need to lock it out. Well, what do I need to do? It's on the tag. If you don't have one of these programs, it's really good, and it's a good safeguard for your associates because they'll always have what they need attached to the machine. Routine maintenance and troubles. Troubleshooting. You can't use an e-stop as a lockout. That's not a control. E-stop means you just de-energized it for the moment. There's still power in the panel. If that device were to fail for some reason, you would still have power. Lockout is the only true
de-energizing, so you can't use this form of a protection. When we have baggers, this is an example of an alternative protection. If you open the door on a bagger, it's got an interlock. It'll shut the machine down. That's great. The operator now has the exclusive control to re-energize that machine. Some facilities actually have put a deadbolt here so that if you shut the door, it can't be re-energized because it'll never reach your set of contacts that makes the door shut. But the associate has exclusive control to restart. This is not anything other than de-energizing. So you still have lockout come into play if you're going to do maintenance. This is when you have a bad bag, you've got to clear a bag. When it comes to your equipment, you really should use, I mean, OSHA actually says that you should have your lockout devices should be standardized by color, shape, and size. Really what they're saying is they would rather your lockout equipment not be a master lock from the hardware store, because that's like every other master lock that you have. If someone sees a master lock on something, they're like, why is it locked out? If you see these type of locks, you know that it is a safety issue. You know you cannot bypass it and cut it off because there's a reason there for it. So by having locks that are designed this way, you actually safeguard an accidental restart. If someone says, well, I don't know why the machine's locked out, let's cut the lock off and run it. When they see this, they know they're violating a lockout rule. The tags have got to be environmentally tolerant. You don't put a paper tag out into a factory. You've got a lot of humidity because it's just going to fade away. And the tags must be identified as danger, do not operate, danger, do not open, do not close, do not re-energize. We'll skip over that. Let's go to machine guarding real quick. We all know what it is. It's basically safeguards that keep our associates from being pulled into the piece of equipment where they would have injury. I like this, it says accidental encounters. Yeah, accidental means your hand got pulled into a belt or your hand got pulled into a chain. You also have to guard against pinch points of the moving equipment. What we do in our plant, which is we'll share with you, is we have an annual machine inspection. And within that, we inspect the guards. Now, you say, well, why would you do that? You came with a guard. You're fine. A guard can get removed by a maintenance person and not put back on. Or maybe it wasn't put back on properly. You can also have a situation where maybe you replaced a shaft. And when you replace the shaft, it's longer than the old shaft. And now this rotating shaft is chewing a hole through that guard. Where that hole is an exposure. So you do a guard inspection once a year. And we do a refresher course with all the associates, and guess what? They sign off on it. Machine guarding is to protect the operator. And these are just some examples. This is a rotating shiv and drive motor. These are tail pulleys. And then here is a pallet conveyor. And it's really hard to guard that. If you can't guard the conveyor, put up a perimeter fence. Something you can move if you need to get in there to work on it. But basically, you're keeping the perimeter empty. Nip points are when you have a situation where your hand or body parts can be pulled into something. And here's some examples. We all have these are chain conveyors. And here's another photograph of a perimeter fence. Common occurrence is pallet dispensers. I've only been with Scott's 29 years, and 29 years ago we didn't even have a palletizer. We stacked it by hand. Now we've got this nice automated equipment. Pallet dispenser actually allows people to put their hands where they could get crushed because the dispenser lifts up a pallet, it drops a pallet, and if you don't guard that in some way, you've got a risk. Have you had injuries there? Probably not. But when you analyze the risk, it should be guarded. And a perimeter fence or mainly the perimeter fence is the bear. You can put a light curtain there as well. Machine guarding and rotating shafts. We've got tons of them in our factories, and some of them are very low, like body height, knee height, because they're low conveyors. I think we all have these. These can easily be guarded. And there are things that you look at and say, well, the manufacturer sent this to me, and they were supposed to make sure it was OSHA compliant. I wouldn't put my money on that, okay? Because it's not the manufacturer's responsibility. It's yours. So if they send you a new piece of equipment and you say the guards look good, you need to actually comb through that and make sure that the guards are adequate for U.S. because it is your responsibility. If it's inadequate in how you installed it, then you got to go back and take care of that yourself. Here's one that you see in factories a lot. You can't have a rotating shaft that sticks out, whether it has a keyway or not. A smooth shaft is still a violation. And the OSHA rule is that the shaft cannot extend. Rotating shaft that ends must be guarded when the exposed shafts extend longer than half the diameter of the shaft. So you can have a little bit of it sticks out, but it's you got to do the math. If it sticks out beyond that, you got to guard it. And you can do that very easily. You can put these caps on that don't rotate. And all the mill supply houses have that. If you have the bearing type that you have and give them that and your shaft size, you can buy these caps that marry up to your bearing. And it's an easy fix and it's pretty cheap. Skip that one. If you have equipment that's intended to be bolted down, you have to bolt it down. If you have a drill press or a grinder, and you may say, well, you know, we might move it, fine, but you better lag it down. That is actually an OSHA violation. The little things that you don't think about that are violations, but they're there. And you may say, well, what's the big deal about that? Well, if they were grinding something and they were pressing against that grinding wheel a lot, the grinding wheel, the table could become unstable. And if it becomes unstable, this wheel's turning 3,600 RPMs and you're sharpening something, you don't want to be in the pathway of that metal when it grabs that wheel, because it'll fracture the wheel, number one. But the metal you're grinding may become shrapnel for you. Powered industrial trucks, probably the biggest risk we have in our industry. We have to make sure that the operation is safe, ensure the safety of the pedestrians in the surrounding area. We're going to make sure that they lift and put down our loads properly. It sounds like an easy job, but it's like herding cats. I mean, in a busy season, you may have 15 or 18 forklifts out there taking product out of your factory, get it on the yard. You got another team that's getting it from the yard onto the trucks. Huge amount of activity, huge amount of risk, and probably with a great amount of temp people driving your equipment. Our job is, I mean, what do we do at Scotts to do that? We actually have in-house trainers. And we do the initial training and a hands-on evaluation. Literally, the guy comes in the door, oh, I can drive a forklift. He thinks he can drive a forklift because he drove there in a car. You guys have been through this before, and you say, okay, let's see. So we put them into our warehouse and say, take that forklift, move these pallets to here, and put them over there. You can tell in about 4 seconds if the guy has ever seen a forklift in his life, because they get on there and like, I don't know where I'm at, don't know what I'm doing. And it sounds cheesy, but these are small things that you vet out the people who claim to be an experienced operator, that you might give them a forklift and tell them to go out there. Well, that guy can do a lot of damage to your product. He can do a lot of damage to your equipment. But the main thing is he could hurt somebody, including himself. We also do a refresher classroom training annually. So if you drive a forklift, you're going to have a refresher every year. We don't want them to forget the basics. And we also do that every 3 years. We have a more stringent one. Again, we have a cardinal rule process around seatbelts. I mentioned that before. If you don't wear a seatbelt and you get caught, you're gone. There's no discussion. There could be a situation where you may kick it up to a safety panel that we have and we would discuss it. But if it's a blatant and a willful violation, you're gone. It's just that simple. You can use mirrors to see around blind corners. That's another problem. If you have, we do pre-pack, and you may have a row of mulch and then a row of soil and another row of mulch. If you burn through that soil and you're halfway through that, now you've created a blind spot, because these two rows are nice and long, but the forklift that goes halfway down that row to grab that soil, he's going to back out. So he's going to back right out into your traffic or to your trucks or other people. So blind spots are a big problem. They're also a big problem in a warehouse when you blow through this door. You got to look out for pedestrians when they're driving in our factories. The pedestrians do not have the right of way. We make them sign off on that. We make them understand that if you are in the area of a forklift or loader or dump trucks, that you have to stand down. It's a part of a job, and you have to get the loader operator or operator's visual, I see you and I know what you're going to do before you move. And I don't care if they stand down for 2 minutes or 5 minutes. You can't have pedestrians doing what this guy is off in an area, and every one of us knows that probably 30% of the time our loaders are going backwards. If you're feeding a box, he's got to back out. If you've been in these loaders, they have mirrors, and nowadays a lot of them have cameras. Don't care. You do this 400 or 500 times a day, you're going to miss this guy that walks behind you. And so it's a really good rule to basically say pedestrians have no rights at all except to get a visual sign-off from the operators. Then you can enter the area. But that's a high-risk one for all of us, I think. You got to use proper lighting when you can, and if you can't see, you use a spotter. Another item that's really important nowadays, this doesn't work very well in the daytime, but we have the blue lights. You mount them here, and as you chase them around the floor, an operator can, pedestrians can see this blue light, and you can see it here. The blue light's about 15 feet either in front of or behind the forklift. So in a tight area where you're moving pallets in, or maybe your operator is doing some work, this blue light is just catches your eye. Again, it doesn't work good in daytime, but inside a warehouse or a production area, these are really invaluable. And some of our plants at Scott's have also, they have a red one that goes on the side that produces a straight line. That's a really good tool as well, because between the blue and the red, you look like a Christmas tree, but you can't say that you didn't see it. I mean, it's very obvious that this equipment is moving towards you. Really helpful if you're at the end of a row where you have pallet racking, or coming from one building to another, if you're transitioning from one warehouse into packaging, this blue light's 15 feet in front of you, so it catches your eye. If you don't have designated walkways, I suggest you do that. If you have someone that walks behind a forklift or a loader and you have an incident, one of the questions that your safety team is going to ask, well, why was that person there? Why was he even there? Why did he do that? We can't necessarily predict why people do that, but we can give them a pathway that we say that if you're going to go out of the door, you need to follow this pathway. If everyone follows that pathway, you minimize your risk. Secondly, if you do this, be careful that you don't overstripe or overmark lines. For example, if you get someone that's really gung-ho, says, I'm going to draw lines to every piece of equipment here. If it's not feasible and repeatable, that's worse than not having lines at all. That means you're not following your own rules. So mark your main walkways and then find out what other walkways that you need to do. I wouldn't overmark, because overmarking, people just, they blow it off. So put down what you know you can enforce and what is sustainable. And that's another example of going transitioning from one building to another. If a forklift with the blue light was there, you would see it if you were on the inside. Also, basically it's an OSHA requirement. I don't think we do it very well as an industry, or I don't think the U.S. industry does it very well in other type of companies. But you're supposed to use a man door when going from one building or going in and out of a building. You're not supposed to use the main door. We enforce that strictly at Scott's. We know that this is for forklift traffic and this is not. If you don't have a door, you should install one. It'll cost you somewhere in the neighborhood of $700 to put one in. But you remove the risk of a forklift coming in contact with your people. And I think I talked about this. If pedestrians are in your way or in your area, they got to announce it. You can use radios, but don't rely on a radio. You know, if you have two loaders, they can talk to each other, but you've heard of situations where two people are talking at one time, nobody heard anything. The safest is to get an acknowledgement that you are in that area. Pits always have the right of way and make eye contact, and of course, high visibility clothing should be what you do every day for your people. This one was close to home for us. We had a factory in the West Coast, and basically, this is an interesting one. We'll step through it. An operator was loading a truck in the dock. It was properly chocked and set up. Now, there were two docks. Remember this. There were two docks, one truck. The operator was loading the truck. This factory has chains across the openings so that when a truck is not there, you won't, like, fall off of that. Another truck backed in, and he removed the chain because he's going to get loaded. And then he noticed that he wasn't square to the dock, so he's going to adjust his truck. Well, the operator came back out with the pallets, and he'd been loading this truck. And for some reason, he didn't notice that there are two trucks now. And he went into the new truck, which makes you wonder what the guy was doing. Well, the new truck was going to adjust his truck. He pulled down the chain. Forklift goes into the truck. Well, the truck pulls away to square back up, and this is what happened. Not a cool thing, but it's just a misstep of procedures. The truck driver should never have dropped the chain. Our operator should have noticed that, that truck wasn't here a minute ago. Why would I go into it? Thank goodness the operator wasn't hurt, but that's just one of these things that's close to home. Electrical hazards. Make sure everything is up to date with OSHA 1910. You got to have arc flash assessments on all of your large panels. Arc flash is what the electrical rating is for the box. You have 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There's been some changes in that rating with OSHA. Everything now is a 2, and 2 requires certain gear, and you got to have that gear that will protect your associates. You got to have 36 inches in front of all the electrical panels. That's so that if you have to get to that panel, there's nothing to impede your ability to get there. So a pallet of bags in front of an electrical panel, you can't get there to turn it off in an emergency, you have a problem. And all boxes and panels have got to be labeled. Just some examples of things you shouldn't have: frayed ends, cords that are stripped, or the casing is off. Here's a conduit pulled out of the bottom. More examples. These look insignificant. If you get an OSHA inspection, they won't be insignificant, even though in our life they are. They'll be a part of a violation. Receptacles without covers. Here's one that should be close to home for people. If you walk into your factory and the panel doors are open, you have people who are going in there to reset the overloads. The question is, are they electrically qualified to do that? If you check the regs, you have to be electrically qualified to go in a panel now to do the resets. That's an OSHA requirement. You should probably brush up on that. If you just have an operator who's been running a bagger for 30 years and he's not electrically qualified, he is not to go in that box. So when you see these boxes that are open, you know people are going in and out of those boxes. So you've got a risk. You've got a really bad risk because, number one, why are they going in there? You should find out what the root cause is and fix it. If it's a larger motor or replace a conveyor, do it. I mean, that you want people to stay out of those boxes, but if they're going in there and they're not qualified and they get injured, you're going to be in a bad place. Examples of things in front of electrical panel, and then the amount of bark dust that you may find in your equipment. These are panels that have clear identification of arc flash. These panels tell you what rating they are, 0, 1, 2. You used to could go into a 0 panel with just minimal training, and now you can't. If you have gear for the class 2 and above, you've got to inspect that annually, and you've got to have it tested every 3 years. That's getting into a whole new territory when you're going into a class 2 and above electrical panel. Let's talk about engagement. So why do we need to engage our associates? Our rules and regulations, they're only going to take you so far. The investigation of the incidents will show what the employee decided. That doesn't help you much. It tells you why it happened. What we really need to do is find out how to get into the heads of our employees to make sure that they make wise decisions. For us, we're just beginning on that journey. Our record didn't look so bad. But we're at a point now where we're here. We've got the building blocks. We've got the systems. We've got the people. We've got the audits. But we aren't going to move forward until we start to change the culture of the plants more. So what do we need? The National Safety Council says you need leadership. You need management that will lead by example. You have to do that. If all you do is say we're going to be safe and you don't put your shoulder behind it and you don't lead by example, your associates will figure that out really quick that you're not committed. You need to integrate those systems into everything. You can't say we're going to have a great safety program next year and then say, well, we need this equipment or we need this guarding, but there's no budget for it. You've got to get it into the budgets. You've got to get it into every facet of the business. You may say, well, our problem is bark processing. Well, no, your problem is from the truck dump to the last package that's loaded on the truck and everything in between. It's packaging, screening, it's quality, it's testing, it's forklifts, it's everything, including your office staff. They all have to be included in the safety program. If you leave any component out, then you're not committed. Performance measurements. You've got to use the measurements of leading and lagging indicators to find out, are we making progress? And that should actually be, you know, a part of your continuous improvement. Your organization core values. You can change a vision statement. You can maybe take your people and recharge them to where we're going to be better on safety. But they should be aligned with your other objectives of margin and quality. You can't leave safety out. It needs to be incorporated into both of those as well. And one of the other pieces is, if you're going to do this, be a corporate, you know, your citizenship to your local community, and you need to also take your safety programs. They should apply to your associates at home. If you cut grass at home, you probably should think about wearing safety glasses. Weed eaters are a great example of what you might need, or even hearing protection. I'm only going to say that if we talk about culture, it is a way to drive safety performance to the next level. You've got to change your culture. It's very hard to do. This is a DuPont-Bradley curve. And within this, DuPont does a lot of work, and this is an injury rate scale. This is high, this is low. Reactive is where a lot of people are. Reactive is when you do safety because of your instinct. Compliance, let's just follow the rules. Get within the rules, that's all I care about. A plant manager may delegate safety to a safety person, but the leader's not involved. It's like, okay, you take care of safety. I'll go do my other work. That means you have a lack of management involvement. When you're in this early stage, your injury rates are going to be very high. And people are going to do, I follow the rules because I have to. And that's not going to get you to where you want to be. You can see the different stages. The next stage is dependent. It means the management's committed. There's a little bit of fear and discipline involved with rules. You value all the people and you have training. That's the supervision mode. The self mode is independent. People develop personal knowledge. They have personal value. They care for themselves and they practice good habits. And you have things like recognition for safety. The final area that you want to be in is interdependent. And this is where you help others to conform. You basically are being your brother's keeper. You network, you care for others, and you're an you have operational pride. The key part of this is, I follow the rules because I want to, not because I have to. How do you improve the cultures? They need to evolve. You've got the building blocks. Understand where you are. You may want to do a survey. Leadership starts from the top. A lot of the people in this room are the leaders of your companies. It starts with you. Setting expectations and vision, engagement associates, and walk the talk. You get the level of excellence, a safety excellence that you demonstrate that you want. I'll point at two small other things. I went to Duke University for a leadership class, and we had a module where we had some people come to visit us from Atlanta, from the Martin Luther King Institute, and I thought it was going to be a civil rights type of discussion. It wasn't. It was about leadership. So what they did is they said that Martin Luther King, you know, as a preacher, he was a civil rights activist, but he was a leader. How he developed some of his synergy was as he went through these little towns and little churches and community meetings, and he learned things that when he said that motivated people, and he also found things that turned them off. His goal was to bring people together. And through that, he developed a leadership style called focus on what's undeniable or undeniable. So if you think about it, some of the famous things that he said is men should be judged by their character. You know what? I don't care what side of the fence you're on. I think everyone can agree that men should be judged by their character. Children should be able to play with themselves, play with other children. Everyone would agree that children should be able to play with other children. He focused on what was undeniable. If you take that leadership concept and you move it into safety, what's undeniable about your company? You don't want to have an accident. You don't want to have an injury, right? But what's undeniable about that? What do you think your employees believe that you want? If they believe that you want to not have an accident because it'll save you money, which it will, or because you'll have less workman comp rates, which you will. If the associate believes that you're trying to do it for you, you know, they don't embrace it. What's undeniable is that associate should have the right to come to work and go home with all their fingers and toes. What's undeniable is you need to make your safety programs about them. If you walked in and asked someone in your company, well, why do they have these rules? Well, because we have to. Well, if we do it, it'll cost a lot of money. A lot of managers take that approach. It's not the money. The day you wake up and your associates face a new rule that you implement, and they know it's because it's about them, is the day that you'll start to get to the right-hand side of that Bradley curve because they want to do it. You're paying for their time. If you implement a new rule that takes more time, you bear that burden. They get it. So think about how you structure your safety communications. If it's not about them, they don't embrace it as much. We know that if you don't have accidents and injuries, all of those things will happen. You will make more money, have less cost, absolutely. But they have to know with every fiber in their body that it's about them. You get the benefit, but it's about them, and they'll embrace it. The final thing I'll leave you with is General Colin Powell. I think when he was in his office, was a really good leader. He had some rules of leadership, and I'm just going to pull one piece of that out. And I don't advocate that you do this the way I'm going to say it, and I apologize in advance, but you can look it up on the internet, Colin Powell's Rules of Leadership. And it basically says, if you're going to change people for a process that you want to make happen, sometimes you're going to piss people off. And that's true. If you take a workforce that you've got some people who work safely, some that don't, some that have been there 30 years, and you implement a new rule, and they're like, I've been here 30 years, and why do I have to do this now? You're going to piss off somebody on both sides of those fences because you implemented the rule for the right reason. But here's the thing. If you try to make everybody happy, that's mediocrity. You're not going to make everyone happy. So what's undeniable? Reach your goal of no accidents. And if you piss off some people on the left or the right for the right reasons, for the family, you're in a good place. If you don't deal with these people on both sides, you're only going to chase away the good people that you have, because they're basically going to say, we talk it, but we don't walk it. So that's pretty much the end of my speech. I'll take on some questions. Larchel is at 24 years. We can see 25. I took over the regional director job 2 years and 6 months ago. When I took it over, the Northeast region had 3 recordables and I lost time. This year, I have 7 factories with 1 under construction, and I have 0 lost time, and I have 0 recordables, because I made our managers understand what's undeniable is we want the associates to go home without injury. It helps me, but the record's worthless. A piece of paper on the wall is totally worthless. What's important is your people know you care about them, and you do it for the right reasons. So that's all I have. Questions?
Anybody have questions?
John, how much does Scott's employee safety committees at the plants? And what would be the composition, ideally, from your experience?
We have a safety committee at all of our plants, and it's a cross-section of, you really need maintenance in there. Supervisor, someone from distribution, someone from bark processing. You need a component from each department in there, and then we rotate those committees on a regular basis. They'll get stale if you don't, but that's what we do. Yes?
I didn't catch the name of the software that's...
Brady, B-R-A-D-Y. B-R-A-D-Y, Brady. Okay. Thank you. Oh, sorry. We have 2 right now. One is a seatbelt, and the other one is you can't bypass any lockout, tagout, or any interlock. And so that's really key. For example, on a PT bagger, if you open the bagger door, you know, the system shuts down. Or the bag elevator, not the elevator, but the bag squeezer that goes up, if something hits that button, it'll shut the system down. Well, an operator might say, well, you know, if this thing didn't shut down every time, I could open the door and do my work while it was still running. That's bypassing an interlock. And, of course, the lockout, tagout is simple. But we have 2. We had more at one time. We had a pretty healthy list. But we really felt like that if we had 2 and we stuck with it, as painful as it can be, then that's the basis of being serious about safety. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take 10 minutes. Got some fresh coffee that just showed up in the back, but let's try to keep it to 10 minutes so we can get going with the next presentation.